Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Help for HD Live. Help for HD Live is brought to you by Help for HD International and is made possible by our sponsors, Teva Pharmaceuticals and Griffin Foundation. Today, we will be talking about the new HDSA's genetic testing guidelines. There has been a lot of questions that have been coming up a lot about these guidelines, so today we have two guests to talk about this subject. Our first guest, of course, is the amazing Dr. Goodman, who we all love and respect, and is we always as a community are so thankful for Dr. Goodman to answer hard subject matter with us and talk about stuff with us that we have a hard time getting answers for. We also have Dr. Thomas Bird with us today, and he's from the University of Washington, and he took part in helping create these guidelines. So thank you both so much for joining us today, and welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Yep, happy to join you.
And yeah, if I can start out.
Oh, great.
Saying that guidelines are hard. It's a thankless job in some ways because you are trying to, a group of individuals is trying to formulate how to handle a difficult, often medical problem or situation, and there will be various opinions. And there is, in Huntington's, very little evidence base, so we are left with opinions from experts or groups, and there is no perfect answer, and there will be often a lot of disagreement. Or different opinions. When I say disagreeing, you have different perspectives. Families may have different perspectives than our organizations or our doctors. So it's a balancing act to try to come up with the best you can, but they're not going to be perfect. Never are.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with that more.
Yeah. Well,
In fact, I would point out that there was never full agreement amongst the people devising the guidelines. There was huge amounts of discussion and differing opinions, and that was part of the process. But it has to be a sort of a consensus statement, and sometimes you almost wish there were like a Supreme Court decision. There were minority opinions that you could put in, but it's a consensus, and it's a moving target that can change with time. And I think that's one of the reasons that these guidelines actually came out, was because it had been a long time before anything like this had been revised or redone in the face of new information.
Right. Yeah. In terms of making guidelines, there are a lot of opinions on how you try to make your best or most trustworthy guidelines, and there have been rules or suggestions that disease organizations have tried to follow. The Institute of Medicine has put out various recommendations on how to go about making guidelines and how not to fall into traps as much as possible. And the European equivalent The Institute of Medicine is North American or U.S., but there's also a European equivalent that have certain kinds of rules or suggestions, recommendations on how to make a recommendation. I think my first comment about the ones that HDSA created there was not clearly defined procedure or process was in terms of developing the present guidelines. And doing that might have made this more transparent. So so that we as viewers would know the various steps that were made, how consensus was built, how the various people who were asked to consult, as was Dr. Bird and Robin Bennett also here at the University of Washington, a genetic counselor who's been around for as long as I have probably and maybe more. These people are wonderful, excellent people with a lot of experience, but we do not know how they were chosen as opposed to someone else. And that helps us know what the breadth of the consensus building could have been. And that would have been a useful thing, I think, for HDSA to have done.
Mm-hmm.
Tom, could you comment on how...
Yes, I'd be happy to comment on that with what I know. And basically, I agree with what you're saying, and I think transparency and process are two very important parts of this. And in fact, that's why all those names are listed at the end of the guidelines, so that people would at least know who had been taking part in it and where they came from. So that information is there, and I think it's helpful to know that. That list of persons was developed by the HDSA office in New York, and I wasn't part of the selection process, and so I don't actually know entirely how they went about that, but it's obvious that they selected people from their centers of excellence who had a long experience in doing genetic counseling and doing this genetic testing, and asked them to come together as a committee. And when they asked me, I said, sure, I think it's important, and I'm happy to come on board. And then it was meeting, and of course, there are people from all over the country, so they couldn't get together face-to-face, but it was telephone conference meetings that went on over a period of, it was certainly more than 6 months. I think it may have been more like 8 or 9 months, with frequent committee phone calls going over the previous guidelines that the HDSA had put together, I think more than a decade ago, and going over those and saying what sounds good, what doesn't sound good, what should be updated, what do you think about doing it this way, what do you think about doing it that way. So there was a lot of discussion, and as I said, there were, and as LaVon pointed out, there was a lot of different opinions. And so this is kind of a consensus. I think I would say moving, and then they were, the guidelines, before they were put online, they actually were sent out to a group of genetic counselors to comment and make opinions and give their feedback. So that was actually done too, which I think was a very good idea. Moving forward, I would say if these were going to be used by a much larger community, I think there should be even a more, complicated and extensive process with even more people involved. I think one thing that's missing is I think it would have been good to have had more feedback from Huntington's families who had been through genetic testing and get their feedback and their concerns. I think that would have been very helpful, actually. I do know that one of the reasons for doing this again this year was that the HDSA office had gotten feedback from families with a lot of questions about genetic testing that they felt were not addressed in the guidelines, and so that's one of the reasons they went ahead and revised them, was because there had been so many questions about this, that, and the other detail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I actually agree with it. That's interesting you say that, because even after the new ones have come out, I know that we've received a lot of calls from people that actually have even more questions now that the new ones have come out. So I think that's always probably something that needs to be built upon and made stronger and better. But yeah, I think that you're definitely right that the family's input is probably very important in something like this, because, and everyone has their own, you know, with my husband, our primary care doctor, you know, ran the test and called us at home and gave my husband his positive results. And he actually didn't even give them to my husband. He gave them to me. My husband was at a funeral of a fallen officer, another sheriff that he worked with. And so actually told me over the phone that my husband was positive for Huntington's disease and basically have a good day and hung up. And and so, you know, I do think that all the Huntington's families have different experiences, and I think, but I also think each expert definitely has something to give into this too, because especially the ones that have worked a long time with families and that have a lot of connections with the families would have a lot of input too on how the families have dealt with it within their clinics. I'm sure LaVon has dealt with many people who have gone through the testing process, and all the experts have. So I think it's good to have the experts involved, but definitely family members as well in this. So I'm glad to hear that there were family members involved in it.
Well, your description of what happened to you personally is a perfect example of why there need to be some guidelines, whether everybody can agree with them or not. It's important to get some things down and try and get some consensus in the larger medical community to try and make those things work better.
It's not good medical practice, and that's what we're talking about here, is good medical practice. What are the guides for that? And when one gives a life-threatening illness or a cancer diagnosis or something like Huntington's, or as momentous, then delivering it over the phone is not good medical practice. Whether you are a neurologist or a genetic counselor or a cancer doctor, so that particular doctor was not following good medical practice. One of my comments about these guidelines is they do. Trying to make them a little less center-centric. Not everyone is able to get to a center. And helping as many generalists as we can or general neurologists as we can to follow just that simple good medical practice of when something is very serious, you come and you talk with that person and have that person come in. So that doctor was not following good medical practice in general.
Right.
And, of course, that everybody agrees that that's not the sort of thing that should happen.
Sure.
Yeah,
I think you're right. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Dr. Bird.
I was just going to say that LaVon raises what I think is a really good, important question, and that is how to provide a good practice genetic counseling, genetic testing kinds of information to people in the broader community where you can't go to a center of excellence for Huntington's or Alzheimer's or cancer or multiple sclerosis, you know, whatever you want to call it. You can't have a center in every community, but there are people that want that information in every community. And it's becoming more and more available because of the remarkable progress that's been made in genetic testing. It's happening more and more in all fields of medicine. So the whole field of medical genetics and medicine is struggling with this issue of how to do this, how to do it properly, and how to get it available in a professional way to everyone in every community, particularly those that are not close to a center. And I think one of the solutions that I see coming down the line, we're not there yet, but one of the solutions is going to be the video conferencing kind of thing where experts and talk to people in small communities face-to-face, live, on video conferencing, and get that kind of information to them in a professional face-to-face way, even though they may be, 200 miles away. The reason I see why that hasn't happened as much as you might expect, with Skype and everything, you would think that would be really easy now. But the big block, apparently, is security issues. To make the conversations secure, to satisfy Medicare, Medicaid, hospitals, secure medical information. A lot of these internet video conferencing things are actually not secure, and the very, very personal stuff is discussed, so they have to be secure. And my understanding is that's one of the big roadblocks now for not being able to do that more easily. But down the line, I can see that as a good way to proceed with this.
And in fact, in Canada, there was a British, at British Columbia, that a study was done through Vancouver, when Michael Hayden was there, to give genetic counseling over such a line in a generalist's office, the whole procedure was done in the generalist's office. The results were given, the counseling was given, and then people who were able to have this kind of genetic counseling, where other family members could come, more of them, because it wasn't such a long distance to travel, and it was also in their community with their community physician. And people preferred that to going to a center. So it's certainly a goal to work towards, but it's certainly one that most people seem to think was better, even if they were within driving distance of a center.
Yeah, I think it's a good idea. In fact, I've personally done it. I can recall I've done it at least twice by phone conference. I've done genetic testing and giving the results to families, and one was in Montana and one was in Wyoming, in small communities, while they sat there in their generalist's office. And we talked. There was a genetics counselor and myself at one end, and the family and the general physician at the other end. And we carried on these conversations and gave that kind of information.
Right. So the reality of it in the States is that most people with Huntington's do not get their care at centers. So providing some instruction, acknowledging that in HDSA's recommendations and giving some ideas, as you have just done, Tom, on how to address this. And so you get the expert geneticist and counselor, you're able then to deliver something that your recommendations will fit.
I think it's a great idea, and it's probably something it's something, for example, HDSA could do moving forward, is to try and expand this concept and say how do we help the families that can't get to a center.
Yeah, and like with my testing situation with my husband, we had a center literally a couple miles down the road from where we were tested, but we didn't even know that center existed. And it's UC Davis Center of Excellence, which is just an amazing center, and we go there now, but we didn't know anything about Huntington's disease. So my husband was estranged from his father, so we didn't know what HDSA or a center of excellence, or we didn't know what any of that meant. We just knew my husband was having trouble, and we were trying to figure out why. And so we have to think about the folks that don't even know about, a center, what even a center of excellence is, because that is out there.
And the genetic testing, it looks like it's too easy. Nowadays, lots of laboratories are doing the genetic test, and all a physician has to do is check off a box on a testing form and send the patient on the form to their lab, and and off it goes. And it doesn't, to the physician, it doesn't look much different from you know, hundreds of other tests that they order every day.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't really realize what they're stepping into when they order a test like that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the difference between protocol and guidelines, because I do think that that has been kind of a question by the community that has been raised. Is this guidelines or is this protocol? Because there is some verbiage used that makes it seem like it would be protocol opposed to guidelines. So could you guys kind of talk about that?
You want to go first, Tom?
Well, I'd certainly like to comment on that, and I can tell you my mm-hmm. opinion. And my opinion
okay.
is that they're guidelines.
Okay.
And although they're called protocol, right, at the very title it says genetic testing protocol, and I think of them as guidelines. And I think what I'm glad that HDSA did was I'm just looking at the preface. In the preface, at least they defined what they meant by the protocol, and I'll quote from it. It says it's a framework of recommended procedures. They are not regulations. Each testing situation is unique. So when they say they're recommendations and they're not regulations and each situation is unique, I think of guidelines. And so that's I consider these guidelines and not some kind of rigid protocol. And I personally think it's unfortunate that they called it a protocol, but that's what they did.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it goes. And I think that's caused more confusion than it ought to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think verbiage is important when you're doing things like this. Protocol
is
what people
ambiguous. Ambiguous for people and hard to understand. And it was an unfortunate choice of term. And I would agree with Tom that guidelines or good practice guides would have been the better way to have said it. And that would have been more consistent with the European nomenclature names as well. Guidelines are meant to be educational tools to teach doctors and also patients and families, to empower patients and families for what good medical practice is, what it should look like. That they're not necessarily something that applies to every patient, and there needs to be flexibility in applying good clinical practice guides because every person's different. And even though they say this in their introductory paragraph, some people don't get that far.
Right.
But
no, absolutely.
But hey, we all say our words wrong sometimes. I think they probably have the message.
Right.
Yeah. I kind of want to bring up a hard subject here just for a minute. I want to talk about juvenile Huntington's disease. HealthReach International has put JHD on like the forefront of our company, and this is where I'm kind of getting the hardest emails when it comes to testing children. And I know this is very hard to talk about, but I also think it definitely needs to be addressed, because a lot of parents are sharing with me that they feel that the delay in diagnosis is actually harming their children. I've had parents that have said their children have been put on medications that have actually hurt their children later to find out that their child had, JHD and not ADD, and they were put on Ritalin, and they felt like they feel like there's a lot of harm being done to their children by not being able to get their symptomatic children diagnosed. And I want to stress that these children are symptomatic. One that I just came across had actual seizures and the whole nine yards, and it took a year and a half for her to be tested. And in that process, she lost valuable time of services as far as physical, you know, her therapies, and she was put on wrong medication, and the family is not happy, as they should, as they have every right not to be happy, because their child, they feel, was harmed. So I kind of want to get your guys' opinion when it comes to juvenile Huntington's disease and the challenges that these families are having to face because their doctors are not willing to test for juvenile Huntington's disease.
Yeah, so it's, as you said, it's a very difficult a problem, and it's and this is an example where each case is unique, usually. And if I think what really helps the most is if the family and the child is seeing a specialist who knows a lot about juvenile Huntington's. And that's mm-hmm. not a lot of specialists because juvenile Huntington's is not common. And so right off the bat, if they're seeing a pediatrician who's never seen juvenile Huntington's before, you're already behind the eight ball because you're dealing with someone that doesn't know the details and all the ins and outs about that particular brand of the disease. And so I think it's really important to see somebody who really knows about juvenile Huntington's. Even saying that, however, it often comes down to a disagreement. In my experience, I've seen it come down to a disagreement between the parents and the physicians as to what constitutes symptoms that make you go ahead and do the genetic test. And I've seen a number of parents, they know their child's at risk for the disease, and so that really bothers them and worries them a lot, and that's very, very understandable. But they get, the way I see it is they often get trapped into seeing things that their child is doing that they immediately think must be symptoms of Huntington's, and in fact, it's not. It's kind of, mm-hmm. Think about how kids behave and what happens to them. And things happen all the time in a child's life that worry parents and that are kind of strange mm-hmm. and unusual and difficult to deal with behavior. But it's normal childhood behavior. So differentiating that from symptoms of Huntington's disease can be really tricky and really different. If a child has a seizure or if a child is having trouble walking and clearly has a gait problem, or their grades are falling off in school, for an A student is now a D student, things like that, I think everyone would agree on needs to be tested. But there is this kind of gray zone where there's a disagreement between the families and the doctors as to what constitutes the important symptoms, and I think it's an understandable disagreement, and that leads to a lot of difficulties, and it's sometimes the parents are right, and sometimes they're not, and it's hard. There is no behavior test that tells you yes, this is juvenile Huntington's and not normal childhood behavior.
Mm-hmm. So I would mm-hmm. make the suggestion, since this is a difficult diagnostic problem or diagnostic situation, giving in guidelines a good practice guide, giving the clinician some handles, giving the clinician, what do you as the expert do to help sort this out? Instead of saying that you have to rule out everything else first before you consider testing a child. You never rule out everything else. That's not a very helpful thing for the non-expert clinician to hold on to try to help this family through the decision process and getting them on to the next step. I know whenever I have having said that, whenever I have a child who comes to me whom I believe may have juvenile Huntington's, I always send them in to Dr. Bird because we're much more frightened of causing harm, and we want the expert to cause the harm so it won't be on our shoulders, so to speak. I'm sure mm-hmm. Tom gets this a number of times. So it's having some handles would have been a good thing to have put in, I believe, my opinion, to put in the guides to help clinicians know what to look for. You know, if the child is steadily cognitively decreasing instead of, you know, increasing what they can do over school time, then that's a very important sign that there may be something going on like Huntington's. So giving the clinician out there who knows less about juvenile Huntington's than something to hold on to look for, to tell the parent or advise the parent, mm-hmm. counsel the parent. So having those useful things in there would help clinicians. And I think that's where guides, where there are problems, is really where you need to put your best effort instead of kind of glancing over it.
Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. I'm looking at the section on testing minors, and it says, unless there is a medically compelling reason, such as a clinical diagnosis or a strong suspicion of HD, but that's never defined. You know, what is a medically compelling reason? I think it would help a lot to have that explained in greater detail, and I think that's what you're saying, LaVon, and I agree. There's not enough information there.
Yeah, the hard things, and I think that's the ones that should be discussed.
Exactly.
Everybody's agreeing on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. I know one family said that their doctor actually was unwilling. He said, I feel like I'm doing this with my hands tied behind my back and throwing balls into the dark. Like he said, I need help here. And he felt, and so he did send them to a COE, and then she had to go to another COE. I mean, she went to, I think, 5 doctors before she finally got a test. But I think that, like, you're right on, LaVon, that these doctors, even the pediatricians, they're scared of treating a child that's even at risk of Huntington's disease. I think it's a scary thing for them. So I think that having a more defined area about expanding on juvenile Huntington's disease and these guidelines, or even creating their own guidelines or creating a new testing protocol, whatever that means, something needs to happen for the JHD families, I believe.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. In fact, there probably should be a separate testing guideline for juvenile mm-hmm. Huntington's disease that goes into considerable detail. It's a very special subcategory of all of this, and it takes a lot of thought and a lot of detail.
Mm-hmm. While we're discussing this, a guideline, while I was thinking about this and actually talking it over with my husband, who tends to think outside the box a little more than me, I know you find that hard to believe, but someone's thinking more outside of the box than me. But why not, in problem cases, have a non-disclosure test in the family? We know there's a family history. The child is having some problems. And the child, everybody knows the child's at risk. The child may know, you know, the parent. Parents certainly know the child is at risk, so doing a non-disclosure test doesn't change their 50% chance of having Huntington's in the future. So what we were talking about, and I wrote on in the HGW article, is you have a positive test if the person's CAG count is in a juvenile range. Admittedly, there's going to be a gray area here, but there would be better answers, I think, to the problematic question, because you, in protecting the at-risk, you're also making things harder for the child who has juvenile disease, and perhaps that could be helped by doing a non-disclosure. A positive test is yes, you have juvenile disease if you have a CAG count within whatever the experts agree on, a CAG count over. And if you have less than that, you would have a negative test, whether you had a clear positive test for adult disease or an intermediate or any of those things. So that would be a negative test for this purpose. So that would be the non-disclosure part. But you would be able then to say, well, this child does have juvenile disease.
As a family member, as a woman with three children, very young children at risk, and a husband with a very high CAG, to me, I don't want to know if my children have Huntington's disease, but if one of my children starts showing symptoms of JHD, I want to know if they have JHD so I can support them as much as I can as a mother. And so I think that this is an excellent idea that we as family members, you know, we'd have to, I think that it's something heading in the right direction of supporting us as families with children that really don't want to know about HD. We don't want to know our children's fate about adult onset, but we do want to know our children's fate if symptoms are showing of juvenile Huntington's disease, so we could be parents and we can support our children. So I think that's, you know, as a family
and
member
only,
and a mother, I think that's fantastic.
Only suggesting this in the child where it's maybe suspicious. Certainly
yes,
not for
right,
all
correct.
Children. No, no, no.
No,
yeah.
No, definitely not. No, definitely not. Yeah, but children that do have symptoms, yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea that I hadn't heard before and well worth discussing. I know that part of the issue in doing that would come down to getting a group to agree on what would constitute a positive test versus a negative test, because the mm-hmm. you know there's going to be a range of CAG expansion size where people
and this
are.
This is why you need
yeah.
a large consensus group.
Yeah.
A large group looking at the evidence, so going across centers and perhaps the ones in Europe as well, probably combining this in an international effort to get those people and how many juveniles are tested in each center and what are the numbers.
Yeah, yeah, no,
you
I
know,
think that's that.
This is
yep.
evidence that should be collected anyway. So you can get some evidence to inform you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great idea to get an international database of phenotype versus genotype in juvenile Huntington's. That's what's needed. You know, what happens when your CAG repeat is 55, for example? What does that mean to the individual? How often does that show up early, and how often does it not show up early? And that really hard data about something like that just isn't there.
Because when we talk about, we have those same sorts of problems when we talk about intermediate alleles. We can only give suggestions of the range it could be. We cannot individualize. So it's not a new situation for HD to look at a problem like that. That's not super clear defined, because it never is.
Right. Yep. I agree.
Well, thank you guys so much both for coming on today and talking about this subject. And I think a lot of questions have been answered that I personally have had, and I've had a lot of people come, not answered, but at least started, you know, at least talked about. So thank you. And do either one of you have any final thoughts at all before we wrap up the show, or anything to say, or did I miss anything?
I have a final question for you,
uh-huh.
a technical question, and that is this podcast saved so that somebody can
yes.
go back and listen to it?
Yep, of course. It is archived, and it's available on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio. So it's available for, and I will send you all the links when the show is concluded for you to listen to the archived versions. Yeah.
Because
the majority of our listenership is archived.
I would suggest that everyone who is on the committee that drew those guidelines should listen to this podcast.
Yeah.
I think that's good feedback for them.
Well, Tom,
yeah,
probably you're the best person to email all of those folks.
I will. That's one of my action items is to let them know that this happens.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on today. And I will send you all those links definitely. And any final thoughts, Levon?
Oh, a plug for guidelines and good practice guides, particularly in the setting where many of our Huntington's families are not cared for by experts. And that is good. We have so few, we have no, other than genetic testing, there are no guidelines for how to take care for a physician or for a family member to go look up and how do you take care of my Huntington's individual. Now, there is the physician's guide that HDSA has put out, and that has been for many, many, many years the best that we've had. And it's a very good source that HDSA put a tremendous amount of good work into, and they found good experts to write this up. It is, however, not a medium that most people, most doctors, will go to find information about Huntington's. And if there were good practice guides made up by our experts that were published in places where doctors can go look them up, have greater accessibility, then that might, you can't guarantee it, you don't know, that might improve care, and it would certainly, if it's open source and families can access it, it's something, it can empower them to help their local doctor know a little bit more about how the experts take care of Huntington's.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my plug. Yeah. There's some coming down the line, slow but sure, not nearly as fast as the genetic testing ones. But guidelines are, in my opinion, very important.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you to both of you for coming on to the show. And as always, you can go to www.hddrugworks.com to read all of Dr. Goodman's amazing articles. She simplifies them and makes them easy for us to understand as the community. And we, as always, thank you for that, Dr. Goodman. And thank you, Dr. Bird, for coming on. It was really nice talking to you. This is the first time I've ever gotten a chance to speak with you. So thank you for taking the time to come on with us today.
It was my pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. I have a couple of announcements before I wrap up the show. On the 21st of this month, Help for HD International will be exhibiting at the Florida Chief Police 65th Annual Summer Exposition. We are excited because we get to talk to law enforcement up and down the state of Florida and talk to them about Huntington's disease. Help for HD International also just secured our exhibiting booth at this year's International Association of Chief of Police meeting in San Diego. Help for HD International will be talking to law enforcement agents and first responders from all over the world about Huntington's disease. We just got notification that our exhibit booth is right next door. It's actually kind of in between the FDA and the DOJ's exhibit booth. So not only do we get to talk to law enforcement and first responders from all over the world, but we also get to talk to the FDA and the DOJ. So it's kind of the perfect meeting, and we're very excited about it. On August 2014, we have a Cocktail for the Cures in Tampa, Florida. On September 10th, we have an event in Bath, New York, Amethyst Card for the Cure. September 10th, we also have an HD Awareness Day in Lompoc, California. And the 24th of September, we have the Live in Hope event in Council Bluffs, Iowa. October 8th, we have Help for HD International Symposium in Florida. And on the 27th, we have a night out for HD in Sacramento. And on the 30th, we have Strike Out HD Law Enforcement Softball Tournament. So that's going to be really exciting. I think that's it for now. And I want you to all, if you guys have any questions about any of Help for HD events or things that we are going to, please contact us at, you could contact me at katie@help4hd.org, or you can visit our website at www.help4hd.org. Thank you, everyone, and have a safe night.